Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. This week, we spoke with Nina Shaw, MD, an associate professor of medicine in the Department of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center, along with Sandy Wong, MD, an assistant clinical professor in the Division of Hematology and Oncology at the UCSF School of Medicine, UCSF Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center, to discuss the predictive value of minimal residual disease and the need for treatment in a patient with smoldering multiple myeloma. In our discussion, Dr. Shaw and Wong consider treatment for a standard risk patient who maintained a very good partial response post-transplant but has minimal residual disease positivity, as well as the merits of observation versus treatment for a patient who is diagnosed with smoldering myeloma and does not meet the slim crab criteria indicating high-risk disease. First, we hear from Dr. Shaw, who shares a case of a 54-year-old man who presented with back pain and mild anemia. Listen on to hear the complete case presentation that led up to his diagnosis of revised International Staging System 1 multiple myeloma and a potential course of treatment.
So today we're going to talk about the first case, which is a 54-year-old man who presents with revised ISS stage 1 disease. This was diagnosed when he presented with back pain and a mild anemia and was found to have a compression fracture at T4. Ultimately, he had labs that showed an M protein of IgG kappa, and that M protein was 2.5. He had slightly elevated kappa light chains, but nothing too remarkable. The anemia was very mild, around 11, and he had normal renal function, normal calcium. He ultimately got a bone marrow biopsy, which showed 40% plasma cells with a translocation 11-14. Of note, his other imaging also showed a possible lytic lesion in the pelvis, but nothing with immediate fracture. So he was diagnosed as having revised ISS1 disease. His beta-2 was normal, and he had no adverse cytogenetic factors and a normal LDH. His albumin was also within normal limits. He was initially treated with BRD for 4 cycles, and he achieved a VGPR, so his M protein went down from 2.5 to 0.2. So he then went on to a high-dose chemotherapy autologous stem cell transplant program with small spolans, 200 milligrams per meter squared, and was still in VGPR after the transplant with an M protein of 0.1. After the transplant, we did a bone marrow around the 90-day mark, and it showed no evidence morphologically of plasma cells, and actually the flow was negative as well, but we had sent the bone marrow off for NGS, and that did show positivity by MRD, or minimal residual disease, by NGS, and I believe his number of clones was 100 in a million. So he had 100 copies or 120 copies in the million cells, and otherwise looked great. So Sandy, I want to talk about what you would do next for this guy with what looks like standard risk disease, 54 years old, pretty good shape, no major toxicities, VGPR after transplant, but MRD positive. What would you do?
Obviously, I think if there is a clinical trial option, this patient will be, you know, a perfect candidate for one. And we both obviously know about the ARIGA clinical trial, and Nina is our site PI, so she can speak more to it. So I think, you know, first and foremost, if there is a clinical trial option and the patient is interested, you know, he would be a great candidate for a clinical trial. Outside of a clinical trial, you know, there is still, you know, not mature enough data to say we can use MRD to change our maintenance strategy. And given that, you know, given his disease risk and his you know, absence of high risk cytogenetics, I would put him on Revlimid for maintenance.
Yeah, I think I would choose the same. And I was thinking our options would be, you know, Revlimid maintenance, which I think is standard of care. This is certainly supported by the CALGB data, also meta-analysis of three different randomized controlled trials. And what's good about these is that they show that there's a benefit of Revlimid no matter what category the patient is in. Obviously, we know that high-risk people do worse, but they still benefit from Revlimid maintenance. So that would be one option that's supported by data. A second option would be consolidation, I guess, either with VRD or even if you wanted to be more aggressive, KRD. And the thought being that, okay, the person's MRD positive, and do you want to make that better? But really, we don't have any data, as you pointed out, Sandy, to support us. And in fact, this person presents very similar to the average person who was on the BMT-CTN-0702 trial, which, as you may recall, had induction therapy dealer's choice, and then a melphalan 200 transplant, and patients were randomized to either get a tandem transplant and then rev maintenance, four cycles of consolidation and then rev maintenance, or just rev maintenance. And there was no difference in those arms. So in this case, I really couldn't make a true argument for consolidation. And there wasn't even an MRD as a decision-making point in that trial. But I also really appreciate that you said clinical trial. And thanks for the plug, because we are conducting the ARIGA trial here at UCSF, and it's being conducted at many sites around the United States. And in this trial, patients who achieve a VGPR or CR after transplant are restaged as per standard of care. And if that bone marrow after the transplant does show at least one in 100,000 positive clones by NGS MRD analysis, that patient is eligible. And in that clinical trial, patients are randomized to standard of care Revlimid maintenance versus daratumumab and Revlimid maintenance, with the primary endpoint being conversion to MRD negativity at 12 months of maintenance. So that would be definitely my choice if this patient was interested in a clinical trial. But absent of that, I definitely would proceed with Rev maintenance. Any other thoughts, Sandy?
I am so glad you mentioned, you know, the Stamina trial, because, you know, part of the ancillary study to that, was the primer study that used next generation flow. And you actually, you know, in their data that they have presented, it seems like, you know, after being on maintenance, conversion rates from MRD positivity to negativity, that there were people that converted from positive to negative. So, you know, it's hard with just one time point, you know, in terms of how these patients eventually will fare. We are all taught that MRD positivity portends a poor prognosis compared to those who are MRD negative. However, you know, I think this is an evolving picture, that people are doing more serial MRD testing. And I think, you know, my hypothesis is that in the future, we will see that, you know, of those that are MRD positive, there are patients that go from positive to negative after more exposure, for example, to Revlimid maintenance. And then, you know, that may very well change their risk opposed to someone who remains positive. The other thing I would point out is that, in the EMN-02-HO95 trial, that trial, they did MRD testing, albeit by next generation flow cytometry, and they basically did MRD testing in patients who got at least a VGPR before the start of maintenance, and then during maintenance. And they show that there are people that, you know, that do convert from positive, you know, to negative after getting a year of Len maintenance. So, you know, you have two studies that basically show that, you know, with Rev maintenance specifically, you can see that conversion happen.
Yeah, I think this question of MRD is really important, and one that we, I think you and I and all our group at UCSF, we talk about so much, because we love to have this information, but for what, right? So absence of a clinical trial, we don't know what to do with it. And it's really important to know that even though we're talking to our patients and saying, okay, you have MRD positivity, and sure, on a curve, that might mean that you would do less well than being MRD negative. We don't know whether it's worth intervening on that to make someone MRD negative, because it might just be reflective of the person's disease biology. And furthermore, not all MRD positive people are the same. For example, maybe this type of patient is somebody who's going to go back into their more MGUS state, which definitely has MRD positivity, but has less clinical significance.
Absolutely. And I think that this is, you know, I think acting on MRD results in the absence of a clinical trial and absence of mature data, I think it's too preliminary to change our treatment yet.
Yeah. I kind of want to just go on this newly diagnosed theme for a minute, because as you know, the MASTER trial is one where people are getting KRD and DARA induction, transplant, and consolidation. And the idea there is if they have two sequential points where they have MRD negativity, they'll come off of the study and just be observed. This is by NGS at a 10 to the minus 5 cutoff. And I really like the study design because it's using MRD intelligently. But one thing that I thought was interesting is, you know, let's say people do great on this trial, but the question is, maybe it's the MRD negative people who should be on rev maintenance, right? So is it that the people, we assume just because you're MRD negative, you don't need maintenance. People are thinking about it about that way, but maybe it's the people who are doing great that will continue to do great even with rev maintenance. What do you think about that?
You know, I think you bring a good point. You know, we don't have that the data to support it one way or another, but that is a possibility that that scenario will play out, and you know, we'll know once these trials are complete.
Finally, Dr. Wong shares a case of a robust 77-year-old woman with no past medical history who presented with fatigue. Her workup reveals an IgGM protein of 1 gram per deciliter, and her bone marrow biopsy showed 10% kappa-restricted plasma cells. Listen on to hear the full case presentation that led up to her diagnosis of smoldering myeloma and the recommended course of care.
This is a patient I actually saw in clinic as a consult. So she is 77, but she's a very robust 77-year-old woman. She actually has no past medical history, and she's actually on no medications. She was diagnosed, with smoldering myeloma, and this was all checked in the context of she has some fatigue, and they just did a workup, and one of the things they sent off was an SPEP. But the fatigue, you know, it resolved and it never came back. But in the midst of this, they found that she had an M protein of a gram per deciliter. It was an IgG kappa, and did a bone marrow biopsy. It showed 10% kappa-restricted plasma cells, and she had elevated light chains as well. Her kappa serum-free light chains was 180 milligrams per liter. Lambda was 10 ratio of 18. PET-CT was negative for lytic lesions. She didn't meet any of the slim crab criteria. The fish which was CD138 selected fish was negative. What will you do in this situation? She's here to get a second opinion in terms of her diagnosis and what to do about it.
I think this is an awesome case because it's actually very common and is one of the most controversial areas of myeloma, which is smoldering myeloma, right? So on the one hand, you have people who technically never would have qualified to get treatment but at some point might progress, and then that they'd rather just not be treated. But then on the other hand, there's people that are thinking, I want to be treated. I don't want to progress and break a bone. So what do we do? The first thing that struck me about this case is that pretty much the only thing I can see as an adverse factor here is the light chain ratio greater than 8, but she doesn't even meet any of the 2/20/20 new criteria. Do you agree that this person isn't really high risk smoldering? What do you think?
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, I mean, by the old Mayo risk model, definitely her light chain ratio was, you know, more than 8. So she does have one risk factor, which portends a risk of progression at 5 years, around like a 4 for patients. But if you look at the Spanish model, the revised Mayo Clinic model, and then more recently, Dr. Mateos, when she applied that model in addition to cytogenetics, she really is considered low risk, and by the most recent model that Dr. Mateos presented, you know, she's really at a 2-year PFS of around 8%, so it's rather low. But she also, by the way, does not have any immunopoiesis either. So she's you know, of that spectrum of smoldering myeloma, you know, she's considered like, you know, a low risk by multiple perspectives. But she's a very anxious lady, and she actually brought this to her clinic visit with me. I think actually her local doctor wanted to start her on Revlimid, so she brings with her the abstract from Dr. Lonial's phase 3 study, where patients with smoldering myeloma were randomized to either lenalidomide or observation, and had shown a, as we all know, an improved PFS. What do you think about that trial?
Yeah, that's a really controversial trial, and it's caused, I should say, trial itself isn't, but it's caused some controversy. So of the possibilities that we could do with this patient, observe, give Revlimid, put on a clinical trial, or start full dose induction therapy. Of course, in general, I always like to choose clinical trial, but absent of that, I think about this data that was presented, which did show an improvement in progression-free survival from getting Revlimid therapy, but so far has not shown an improvement in overall survival. And for me, I think this is a big deal because I really, there are different styles that people approach, but I actually am very big on quality of life. And I think that starting medication on people always affects quality of life. I mean, it's not the same as nothing. And it does make people at least have to do more administrative work, if nothing else. And I think there's always side effects that we can't predict. So if I don't think there's enough risk for this patient, I really wouldn't put them on any therapy, even with that trial. And if I'm not mistaken, Sandy, can you remind me, that trial had people with higher risk than this person, right?
So actually, they actually had a pretty good distribution of patients with low risk, just like her. Around a third of patients were low risk, just like her, and a third of patients were intermediate, and a third of patients was high risk. So they had a nice spread of patients, actually. And what I thought was, you know, interesting is that if you look at in that paper, if you looked at, you know, just those patients that are just like her, who are, you know, in the low risk category, you know, they really, 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 if you look at the curves in this subset analysis, of course, there really wasn't much PFS benefit. And so, you know, and as a result, this trial, to me at least, was the benefit was really in patients that were intermediate or high risk. And we explore that together. There's other things, you know, I like what you talked about in terms of toxicity. There is, there is no such thing as a free lunch. Every drug comes with its own toxicities. And in this situation, Revlimid also can cause financial toxicities, right?
That's a big deal.
It's a very big deal. And, you know, so that's one thing. And the other thing is that even though, Revlimid alone is, you know, it's pretty well tolerated, but in their study, they still reported, you know, grade 3-4 heme or non-heme AEs in, you know, a little under half of the patients. And you know, I don't know, I mean, how many of patients had like neutropenia, for example, but that would require more interventions like Neupogen, et cetera, you know, so it's not without risk and not without toxicity. And the other thing that you know, we talked about, she's 77, but she is very robust. You know, if she were ever to develop myeloma, she is someone that, you know, could potentially be considered for a, you know, some sort of transplant, albeit, you know, probably dose reduced given her age. And the question is, you know, for people who are on Revlimid for long periods of time, you know, would we be able to collect stem cells for folks that have prolonged IMiD exposure? We don't know that data, right? You know, you know, some of that will come with time, but that's certainly a toxicity, because what I think important to see is, you know, does that, if we're not able to get stem cells from these patients and move them on to stem cell transplant, have we done them a disfavor by giving them a prolonged period of IMiD exposure?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And it's funny because one of your options here that we talked about is induction chemotherapy. And it's always funny because, you know, we're in myeloma where we're talking about, let's give Dara KRD up front, right? And then we get this smolding trial and we're like, oh, let's just give Revlimid. And it's like, well, if you're going to do the whole thing. You know, so I always wonder about this. And if you think about the Gem-CSER trial presented by Dr. Mateos a couple of years ago, they had high-risk smoldering myeloma patients. Those people got the whole thing, you know, I think of Dara KRD, transplant, the whole thing. And of course, they showed wonderful outcomes as far as response rate. But I remember thinking to myself, oh my God, it's a lot. But at the same time, if I'm going to treat someone with smoldering myeloma as if they have myeloma, I would just do the whole thing, because then I might as well just take them to transplant, get their stem cells collected, et cetera. Because you're right. If we put someone prolonged Revlimid and that isn't successful because in fact they needed more therapy, now you've lost Revlimid as a drug when they progress, number one. And number two, you've subjected their marrow to some sort of toxicity, which might make it difficult to collect stem cells, especially in an older person. So I think in these cases, you know, what are people really afraid about, right? They're afraid that they're going to break a bone. They're afraid that they are going to have kidney failure. They're afraid that they're going to have symptomatic myeloma and no one's watching. And I think one of the most important things we can do as providers is give them reassurance. So to say, okay, we completely agree that there's a risk of progressing because it's smoldering, so that's real, albeit maybe a lesser risk than high-risk smoldering, so this person has a lower risk, but that we are going to watch your labs at least for the first year, every 3 months, and I personally do like to do annual bone marrow and imaging because I feel like that gives us an idea of what's going on with the patient, that they haven't met any slim crab criteria, which is when you combine with the light chain data, and also a DEXA, because I think a DEXA can be a very useful bone density test to figure out if this person has widespread osteopenia, which some people, which is very possible in a 77-year-old woman for sure, but definitely needs to be treated because these people do have risks of secondary skeletal-related outcomes.
I absolutely agree. I think for those patients that are being observed, you know, I think once folks are diagnosed with, you know, MGUS or smoldering myeloma, you know you're going to be watching them. So that even if they progress, the idea, the hope is that you'll catch them earlier on in their progression before they have any sort of irreversible, you know, damage. I mean, granted, yes, you know, there may be a lytic lesion, but hopefully you can catch it before they actually are symptomatic from it. And these patients, I completely agree with you. You know, you follow them every 3 months vigilantly, and with imaging yearly to make sure that, you know, you're not missing any progression. Definitely cheaper than being on Revlimid.
Yes, definitely cheaper. Yeah, I don't think people like the bone marrow so much, but it's definitely cheaper than being on Revlimid for sure. And you know, those bone marrows, you don't have to send them for MRD and all that. You can send them for FISH. I mean, you know they're going to be MRD positive, so no point in sending that. You just send them for morphology, make sure your percentage isn't too high, and then FISH to see if there's clonal evolution. Speaking of this, what would you have done if this person was 77, 15% cap of restricted plasma cells, but now the FISH is 14/20 or 4/14. How does that change what you do?
Yeah, I think, you know, that certainly, I think, changes her risk. You know, in Dr. Mateo's study, you know, that would be considered, that would be a ding against her because of her cytogenetics. So I think her risk profile would change. I think that it gets a little trickier because then she's more in the low intermediate category. I think in her situation, given that she, she obviously everything has to be tailored specifically to the patient. I mean, for me, I still think that, you know, the arguments that we had laid out still apply, is that, you know, I will still be reticent in starting treatment in this patient. You know, I'm of the camp that if we were going to treat this, we should treat it with good therapy as opposed to, you know, just giving Revlimid and then potentially not being able to transplant her when she actually, you know, needs it.
Yeah, I agree. I actually probably still wouldn't start her on therapy even with high risk findings. I actually have a patient very much similar to this, and I'm just extremely vigilant about watching that person very closely with labs and with bone marrow. And every time I get that bone marrow back, I'm always like, ooh, you know, when am I going to see it? And it's been stable, thank God. So that's good. We talked about two cases here. I wanted to sort of pick your brain one little last thing. Our first case had a patient with translocation 11/14, and I just wanted to ask you, now that we have more data on venetoclax, if this person had rev maintenance after, you know, had a VGPR after transplant, has rev maintenance, and then starts to have a biochemical progression, at what point would you be interested in using venetoclax as a second-line treatment, given what you have seen so far?
You know, with venetoclax, I haven't been moving it up in terms of what line I give that drug, only because we don't really know what the toxicities are in combination with, for example, carfilzomib. I'm not using it as much with Velcade because of the Bellini trial, but I am using it with carfilzomib, and I've been usually using it in patients who are multiply refractory, and in which case, you know, and they're running off options, in which case then, you know, the risk versus benefits of trying venetoclax with carfilzomib may weigh in favor of of benefit. So I've mostly been, you know, using it in that situation. I really haven't moved it up only because there are other therapies we can reach for where we know this, the, you know, safety profile, you know, is much clearer compared to venetoclax. So, you know, obviously if this patient were to relapse, there's, you know, the DARA-based therapies, you know, ELO-based therapies, et cetera, that's available to her, even carfilzomib-based therapies. And I just feel like, you know, moving the venetoclax up without, you know, given what happened with Bellini, without a phase three clinical trial, is still, you know, still experimental at this point in time.
Yeah, I've definitely gotten more comfortable thinking about it for translocational 14 people and definitely not thinking about it for other people. You know, I kind of, that's sort of an exclusion criteria for me now. And one thing I think I was taught and re-humbled by the Bellini trial is that if you're going to use it, especially in combination with the proteasome inhibitor, that you have to be really on top of the antibiotic prophylaxis. And I thought a lot about that. And even a little bit of dose reduction, I think before I would have been like running for the 400 and 800, maybe starting lower when you start and then getting good control of any infections, et cetera, making sure there's none, and then maybe ramping up the dose a little bit. So this is sort of a stylist work in progress, I think. And I'm hoping we'll be able to have more information about it as time goes on.
I completely agree with the very good supportive care and antimicrobial prophylaxis. I routinely put patients on levoquin for prophylaxis with their getting venetoclax, just because, you know, it looks like the mortality from the Bellini trial was really in the form of infection. So, you know, as an extra precaution, that's what I've been doing across the board. But, you know, I think eventually, you know, as there are more trials with this drug, we'll, you know, eventually see, you know, how this really measures up for example, venetoclax, carfilzomib, you know, versus carfilzomib, you know, by itself. We'll see whether or not, you know, there's another safety signal there.
Yeah, I agree. Any other thoughts about either newly diagnosed myeloma or smoldering? I think we talked about most things. Maybe one thing that I'm sort of interested to find out for you, your opinion on is, we might find out that KRD is better than BRD. We don't know that data may be presented this year. We don't know yet. And we might find out that DBRD is better than VRD. So how do you choose? Let's just say that happens because we have some primary endpoint data on Griffin. How do you choose between DBRD versus KRD? What would you do? I mean, I know it depends on the patient and everything, but I just can't decide if one of them is better than another.
Did you say how do you choose between KRD and what was that other one?
DARA VRD, if both of them end up being better than VRD.
Yeah, that's a really tough one. I mean, right now I'm not using, I'm not using DARA VRD currently in my newly diagnosed patients just because, you know, it's very difficult to get that without, you know, having that on this label.
Right.
You know, So that you know, it makes it clearer in terms of the decision making. But eventually, you know, when DARA VRD gets an FDA approval, you know, I think if you look at just kind of toxicity wise, you know, DARA is a very well tolerated drug, and I mean, you know, obviously, you know, the Griffin study, this is minus, like, you know, I don't have the data from the full data set from the Griffin study, but DARA is a very well tolerated drug, and it is and there is no, you know, there's none of the cardiotoxicity risks that you may see with the carfilzomib, and technically with KRD in the newly diagnosed setting, you know, typically, you know, you're supposed to give it twice a week, though I know some of us have moved on to once a week dosing. So, you know, I think I would be more in favor of DARA VRD, you know, in the future if it gets an FDA approval.
Yeah, I think for me, it'll come down to toxicity, just like you said. I think DARA is pretty well tolerated, but I also think Velcade neuropathy is an issue, and the way it was dosed in the Griffin study is twice weekly, which I tend not to do as much anymore. So I don't know what I'm going to do either, but I think it's going to be worth discussions even as we get more data mature, hopefully this coming year. So I think that's all we have for our two cases, and hopefully we'll be able to have more data as the year comes through.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to Onc Live On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for recaps from our State of the Science summits and exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLive SOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.